For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Okay. Let's read chapter 4. Finally, dear brothers and sisters, we urge you in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ to live in a way that pleases God as we've taught you. You are doing this already, and we just encourage you to do more and more. For you remember what we taught you in the name of the Lord Jesus. God wants you to be distinct, so you should keep clear of all sexual sin. Sexual immorality. The word is here is the word porneia, a very broad term that has to do with all manner of morally wrong sexual behavior. And so he says, abstain, keep your life clear and free from sexual immorality, porneia. He says, and that each of you know how to possess his own vessel in distinctiveness and honor, not in lustful passion like the Gentiles who don't know God. Now, I've changed the word sanctification to distinctiveness here because that's what it means. And I don't think sanctification is even a translation. What does sanctification even mean? I don't think most of us could even say what it means. So I think we should translate into English. And what it means is distinctiveness. It means that you're different, that you're changed from what you were before. Also, this little saying that you know how to possess your own vessel. I think your vessel in this passage is referring to your body, you know, like the container. And I'm scandalized by the suggestion of some interpreters, including scholars, who say that this means a wife, that this is referring to the wife, who is like a vessel, a receptacle. And I think that is horrific reading. First of all, men don't own their wives, according to the Bible. And why would we be addressing only men here about their wives? This is talking to all Christians and talking about possessing your vessel is your body in distinctiveness and also in honor. And even there, even with honor, I'm not so happy about that. This word distinctiveness is fine. That means different than the neighbors. So here they're in a Greco-Roman city, which is, you know, going to be rampant. You'd have to come up to the modern era. You probably have to come up to today to match the level of rampant sexuality that was there in the Roman world. They really went for it. And Paul's saying, you know, we're different than that. We're not the same as the neighbors here. They have one way. We're different. That's what sanctification is. That's what distinctiveness is. This word, honor, is normally translated as a price, as a high value that you place on something. And so I think, yeah, that would be a better way to understand it, because I don't know what honor really means in this context. The point is that you're possessing your body in distinctiveness, and in a way that is different than the rest do, and with high value, placing a high value on the importance of your body, which God does. We're told in many passages, God places a high value, not just on the soul and the spirit, but on our bodies as well. Now, Paul tells the Corinthians he raised Jesus from the dead bodily. He's going to raise us from the dead. And that shows that we should honor God with our bodies. We've been bought with a price. Not, he says, in lustful passion like the Gentiles who don't know God. So the problem, people that live their life in lustful passion, the heart of their issue is that they think that the body is only good for stimulating and engaging in pleasure. And they actually have a low view of their own body. Now, if you don't know God, he says, like the Gentiles who don't know God, if you live in a world without the infinite personal God, hedonism does make a certain amount of sense. Because, you know, if your life doesn't really have that much meaning, if you came from nowhere, you're going to nowhere, you are nothing, then what really matters? Might as well try to have some pleasure in the meantime. You know, and so I think there is a case to be made that one way to withstand the no God world would be in hedonism. And that's what a lot of people did. But the real problem is that you don't know God. Let's say, you know, you have a materialist. Let's say one of your friends is an atheist, not a believer in God, a non-theist, whatever, agnostic. That person can never say anything to you honestly except, "I love your body." Because to that person, that's all you are, is a body. Right? They're materialists. You got to think about that. That's really what love is to the materialistic mentality. It's the love of the physical. That's all there is. Obviously, we're not in that camp. And porneia is usually comes as a result of an inner sense that my life is kind of meaningless and I don't have a purpose, and so I'm just kind of chasing around and trying to mount people, or get off in different ways, and it's usually a statement of a deeper problem. It's the real problem is there's not knowing God. They don't know God. This is why they're living this way. We do know God. We shouldn't be living that way. It's really an absence of love. That's what porneia is all about. The whole thesis of this section is that porneia is not love, and it cannot be construed to be love. It's the antithesis of love. Porneia is when you seize a person and use their body for self-gratification. It's the furthest thing from any concept of serving love you could ever think of. And so we've got a big argument here with our own culture as well. He says in verse 6, "See that no man transgress and defraud his brother in the matter, because the Lord is the avenger of all these things, just as we also told you before and solemnly warned you." So, to defraud his brother, I take it that this means by committing adultery. Most people were married. You got married when you were teenagers back then. So these would probably be all married people. And so if you got it on with someone, it's probably somebody's wife or a husband. But they used the main, they didn't, this was before gender neutral language. And the matter, because the Lord is the avenger of all these things, just as we warn you. Now, do you see a theological problem right here? He's speaking to Christian believers, and yet he's saying God is the avenger of these things. So God's going to avenge you? What is he going to do? It sounds like, once you're a Christian believer, that you're basically forgiven and you're pretty much guaranteed that you're in there with God. Still, yeah, that's true. But a lot of the judgment of God is passive judgment. It's basically that the punishment for engaging in this way of life isn't that God, smites you with a lightning bolt or something like that. But it's actually in some ways worse than that. It's where God just takes his hands off and says, "Okay, do it your way." And so the no God thesis kind of becomes its own punishment. The suffering that ensues when we live a life this way is a punishment. It's a discipline from God. So we've got a huge disagreement in this area, just as they utterly disagreed in their point of view from their culture, and that's why Paul said we need to be distinct here, we need to be different. We disagree with our culture, and in postmodern culture, we are miles apart on this question. And so I think as thoughtful and real walking, believers and followers of Christ, we have to think carefully about some of the main theses that would be advanced today by our culture, and how do we respond to that? For instance, the idea that, you know, Victorian culture imagined that free sex would violate the so-called will of God, but actually it's harmless, and, you know, people can show love for each other sexually, and that's, you know, Victorian, creepy fundamentalists all uptight about that, you know, making love. Well, that's how they felt. F.F. Bruce describes how back in Thessalonica, a man might have a mistress, Thyatira, who would provide him with intellectual, also with an intellectual companionship. His institution of slavery made it easy for him to also have a concubine. He could own a sex slave, no problem. While casual gratification was readily available from a harlot, a porne. They were all over these cities in great numbers. The function of his wife was to manage his household and to be the mother of his legitimate children and heirs. This is a very, you know, gross situation, particularly, you know, unfortunate if you happen to be a woman, because this was all set up to favor the men in that kind of culture. They were just gratifying themselves all over the place. And then they keep this wife at home. She's the draft horse. You know, she's there to pull the plow. That's about all she's good for. The fact of the matter is that this whole, you know, pornea perspective is a denial of who we are. At the very root of it, we've been created a certain way by God. If we live in accordance with what we've been created to be, then things work out pretty well and we have a pretty good life. But if we live a way of life that cuts directly across the grain of what we really have been created to be, then that way of life will fail at every point. As the book of Proverbs says, there is a way that seems right unto man, but the end thereof is the path of destruction. Misery comes to people who choose to live a life of pornea, and often they're very slow to recognize it. Research, like this study in developmental behavioral pediatrics, backs it up. Their tests and their test sample showed that adolescents who were sexually active had significantly higher depression scores than non-sexually active subjects. That depression was positively correlated with the number of partners in the previous 3 months. So the more sex you had, with the more people you had it, the more depressed you were. Having a strong sense of purpose in life, though, was significantly negatively correlated with the number of sexual partners in the previous 3 months. So in other words, teenagers that had a sense that their life had some sort of purpose didn't feel the need to go out and take sex all the time, give it up. And a lot of this, you know, is giving up sex in order to get a sense of purpose in your life, a way to buy love and to get love feelings. Love feelings is really what we're after, but we construe it to be sex, and the result is pretty pitiful. I don't know how many friends I've sat around with and listened to their misery stories go on, and it's, you know, from one lover to the other, and how betrayed they were here, and let down there, and so on and so forth. And they're in agony, and you're just like, can't you see what this is doing? How is this working for you, this whole pattern? You turned away from God so you could live this way of life. It sounds great. Send me a postcard. Sickness. I'm not even going to get into that. We're all perfectly familiar with that. Inability to form successful families later on. Now let's start talking about the real damage. We say, oh, it's harmless if you have sex with people. Not true. Not true at all. As a matter of fact, we're cutting into our ability to succeed at something very important. And people always just assume, well, I can just mess around because I'm pretty young and I'm going to do the family thing later. Don't count on it. Let's see what the research says on this. This is Popenoe, a professor at Rutgers University In his essay, The State of Our Union, 07, he says, there can be no doubt that the institution of marriage has continued to weaken in recent years. Whereas marriage was once the dominant and single acceptable form of living arrangement for couples and children, it is no longer. Fewer adults are married. More are divorced or remaining single. More are living together outside of marriage or just living alone. We're in a culture that's giving up on marriage. Marriage has been such a catastrophe in Western culture, people are just absolutely giving up on it and are cynical about even the possibility of a successful marriage. The only major family trend that has actually reversed direction is divorce. But this can be quite misleading as well. Divorce in the U.S. Census is measured in divorces per 1,000 women or per 1,000 men. But marriage is measured the same way. So marriage has been declining. Divorce per 1,000 people has been declining, but marriage has been declining too. So the ratio between them has stayed the same. There's still about half as many divorces in any given year as there are marriages. That's the same as it was when divorce was at 5 or at 7 per 1,000 and marriage at 14 per 1,000. Now it's down to 3.8. But marriage is down to 7. Nothing's really changed. Just no, people aren't getting married. After rising steeply, beginning around 65, the divorce rates dropped gradually since the early 80s. The reasons for the decrease in divorce rate are the rise of non-marital cohabitation and a decline in second and subsequent marriages. Yeah, people just live together. He says the divorcees, for example, have become more likely to cohabit rather than to remarry, thus avoiding remarriages that have always had a disproportionately high risk of divorce. If you get divorced once and you remarry, your chance of divorce doubles. It goes from 40% the first time to 80% the second time. But divorcees today are kind of learning their lesson and just not getting married again. They just live with someone. That's the cynicism. Percent of adults between 20 and 30 who are married in the U.S. from 1960 compared to 2010. Look at that. Less than half as many people married. And asking people in that age range, do you want to get married? They're very ambivalent about it. Less than most of them are not sure or they really don't. So this is really documenting the trend toward despair over the concept of a successful marriage. Percent of adults cohabiting in the U.S., look at that, from 5% in 1960 to 48% in 2010. Good Lord, that's tenfold increase. It's all pointing to the same thing, which is that the sociological turn toward free sex is really undermining not just the success of marriage, but even people's concept or belief that such a thing is possible. And so what we're given in the biblical ideal, which is committed, lifelong love relationship, including sexuality, and providing a venue for a family, is something that people are quite cynical about, and I probably don't need to tell you that. You're probably well aware that that's the attitude around. You may feel that way yourself. A lot of people are really scared about marriage. They've seen such ugly things in the breakup of their own parents' marriage and so forth that it just gets, and friends that couldn't stay, couldn't make it. Children get demolished in this picture. This is something that often is flying under the screen. I don't know why there isn't more talk about it. But the American decline in marriage and inability to hold marriage together, highly destructive to children. Here is the percentage of U.S. live births to unmarried women. Gone from 5% to 41% of all live births. This does not include children of divorce who were born to a married woman But they're now divorced. That adds another huge contingent, so that today, by far, the majority of American young people are not from an intact family. Or if it is intact, it's not the one that they were born into. Okay, so what? Who cares? Well, do the readings. Read the research on this. I wish we had about an hour just to go through study after study after study. Longitudinal studies have been done on this that go 25 years where they followed kids from all the way up into advanced adulthood. And all of the research is unanimous. Parent absence, children of divorce, and illegitimacy. Huge adjustment problems for kids in that position. More difficulty in school, more behavioral problems, more negative self-concepts, more problems with peers, more trouble getting along with their parents. This is a motto in Keith from the University of Nebraska, a 20-year longitudinal study. This Norwegian study showed early maternal employment was associated with higher levels of behavioral problems among school children, higher levels of problems where when there had been a higher degree of maternal employment. So the more mom has to work, the higher the problems with the kids, and hence the non-parental care for the first 4 years. They had carefully controlled this study for sex, for IQ, for socioeconomic status, and for daycare experience. So they basically had control for those factors and could basically show that those were not relevant factors in the adjustment difficulty that kids are having. Single parenting is extremely difficult to pull off. It's bad. It's something that we shouldn't do. We should try to avoid that. It's not God's pattern. Here's a different longitudinal study they did, and they showed those who experienced parental absence compared to those who did not achieve less education in life, earned less per year, and attained lower occupational status. And this is like 20 years down the pike. These kids whose parents broke up or who for some reason had only one parent. Children pay the price for our inability to succeed in a marriage relationship. A lot of you know that by personal experience, don't you? You're in one of these families. You've paid a price. You're trying to recover from that. It's sad. Really, we face the loss of true sexual love when we dilute our ability to give our heart to people because we're out running around playing the field and sleeping with different people. The shame that we feel, the inner distrust for other people. We know that I've gone out on her, and so why would she not go out on me? I mean, it just follows the logic. Why is it that we live together but we're not willing to get married? Isn't it because I'm keeping the back door open in case I want to get out of here? Of course that's why. It's exactly why. And so it's a distrustful environment. How can you trust somebody that's working on that premise? Then I'm okay with you now, and I definitely want to use your body to gratify my thirst. But marriage, commitment, not ready for that. Not ready for that. Actually, this entire premise is just wrong. Absolutely wrong. What about the idea that old school marriages were oppressive, especially of women? All they knew was suppression, but not how to express your true feelings. So it was just repress. And they weren't being true to themselves. So they just stay in these marriages. None of this is true either. Popino talks about how the empirical evidence is now strong and persuasive that a good marriage enhances personal happiness, economic success, health, longevity. Really, anything that you can measure is rated higher by married people. And so how do we know that they're happier? How do we know that they're better off? It's not that the researchers are saying that. This is what people are reporting themselves. And marriage ranks at the top. It's the gold standard. more sex, enjoy sex more, happier with their life. Again, I just urge you, do reading in the sociological research in this whole area. Nobody suffers, and the idea that marriage is harsh on women is the antithesis of what is true. Nobody suffers more from the breakdown of marriage than women. Women suffer the most. They're usually the ones with the kids and have to withstand the fate of being a single mother. Poverty among children in the U.S. has risen substantially, and it's because of marital breakup. And because mother is trying to take care of kids and trying to work a job, daycare usually cancels out up to half of their income. And so this is just a little horse crap. What about, you know, this concept? By checking out my lover first, that way, I'll be more likely to succeed when we get married. You know, just we got to test drive the car. Wouldn't want to buy a car without test driving. What if there was a problem? You know, you wouldn't know till you were married. See, there's a way that seems right unto man. It seems like, well, it seems like it makes sense, but actually that's just the antithesis of the truth. Here's a Gallup did a study, a nationwide study on attitudes and on cohabitation and so forth. And they asked, do you think it's cool to live together before you get married? Well, by more than two-thirds of teenagers say, yeah, definitely. And we found that, too, in our work here, in our interviews, we can't even get one person out of 20 on campus here to say, no, there's something wrong with that. You know, everyone agrees. No, you got to live with the person, because how are you going to know if it's going to be a good marriage or not? Well, what do the facts show? Today, if you get married, but you don't live together beforehand, you stand a pretty high chance of divorce, 41%. And that's a pretty scary number to think about. Close to half of marriages ending in divorce, and the most painful experience you're ever going to have, probably in your whole life. And with lifelong consequences, that's a scary number. In marriages where they do cohabitate, it's nearly twice as high, 81%. Well, wait a minute. I thought we were checking it out here. I thought we were seeing if this was going to work, and that's, you know, it's a, nope, not how it works. Here's Pope and Owen Whitehead, again, experts on marriage in America. Living together before marriage increases the risk of breakup after marriage. Unmarried couples have lower levels of happiness and well-being than married couples. That, again, that's not the researcher's opinion. This is what they are saying in the survey that they're taking. They're rating their own life as less happy. No positive contribution of cohabitation to marriage has ever been found. None. While marriages are held together largely by a strong ethic of commitment, cohabiting relationships by their very nature tend to undercut this ethic. Oh, they got it. Sure, that's exactly what it is. The whole point of cohabiting is you're on probation here. It's like, well, you're going to get the test drive. And now I'm trying to decide whether you're good enough or not. And I haven't decided yet. So it's like, you know, it's the antithesis of commitment. We're explicitly not committed. And I could walk out of here tomorrow and pay no price for it. This is bull also. Raw bull crap. And finally, then, well, there's the growing thought that marriage isn't that important anyway. Who cares about it? That is also crap. Let's read the 10 reasons that males in America give, the top 10 reasons for why they aren't getting married until later. First, they can get sex without marriage more easily than in times past. Surprise, surprise. Think about that, ladies. They can enjoy the benefits of a wife by cohabiting rather than marrying, so why get married? Yeah? I mean, from the perspective of the world, from the material perspective, I guess you can see that. They want to avoid divorce and its financial risks. It's financial risks. Yeah, not even worried about the personal cost, just the money could cost me some money. They want to wait until they're older to have children. They fear that marriage will require too many changes and compromises. All of these are really saying the same thing, aren't they? The best advantages for me come from not doing this. Yeah. They're waiting for the perfect soulmate and she hasn't appeared. I'm sitting here tapping my feet, waiting for Mrs. Perfect to show up. Selfish. They face few social pressures to marry. Nobody is saying you should get married. They're reluctant to marry a woman who already has children, so that's her problem. I'm not going to get involved in that. They want to own a house before they get it. First things first, okay? The house, the material goods, that comes first. And they want to enjoy single life as long as they can. And so it's a litany of the self-first thesis. You see what I mean when I say that this whole mentality is about as far from the idea of serving love as you could get. It's all self-serving self is what it is. Using other people, serving self. Let's think along these lines while we're on the subject. Pornography kind of fits into this picture as well. And I'm convinced that, when we see the average marriage age go up to 28 in America, it's not because people aren't having sex until they're 28. You know that. They're having all kinds of sex. And a lot of people are also hooked on pornography. It's a growing, alarming feature. Of course, pornography's been around for a long time, but you used to have to go to a porno store or something to get some porno, which there's a major deterrent to that. It's not something people wanted to do. And now we just have, the push of a button, and we've got it piped into our private room in any way, shape, or form. Let's see some of the findings of Patrick Fagan, who's a clinical psychologist. He's talking about these are the findings in their clinic in connection with porno. Married men who are involved in pornography feel less satisfied with their conjugal relations and less emotionally attached to their wives. Wives notice and are upset by the difference. Pornography use is a pathway to infidelity and divorce, and is frequently a major factor in these family disasters. Among couples affected by one spouse's addiction, 2/3 experience the loss of interest in sexual intercourse. Both spouses perceive pornography viewing as tantamount to infidelity. Both of them, the one doing it and the other one too. Pornography viewing leads to a loss of interest in good family relations. It's obsessive compulsive behavior. It's addictive. Neuroscientists are beginning to map the biological substrate of this addiction. Users tend to become desensitized to the type of porno they use, become bored with it, and then they seek more perverse forms of pornography. Men who view pornography regularly have a higher tolerance for abnormal sexuality, including rape, sexual aggression, and sexual promiscuity. Prolonged consumption of pornography by men produces stronger notions of women as commodities or as sex objects. Yeah, no kidding. The whole pornographic ideal, where sex is just shapes on a screen, utterly subhuman. This is crap also. It's all crap. Let's go back to our premise. Here, it takes us right back. Here we are. What is it going to be? We need to learn to possess our vessel in distinctiveness and high value and not in lustful passion like the Gentiles that don't know God. Now, the servant love picture, let's turn the coin over. We've been talking about the wrong view. And by the way, all the researchers that I cited, none of them are Christians. Those are all secular studies that I was quoting from. So this is not a religious point of view at all. These are secular sociologists and psychologists doing those studies. Under servant love, the first thing we notice is that all of us sense and feel a need for that lasting, committed relationship. That is our architecture. This is what we were made to be by God. And let's go back to the more secular studies. Here's Gallup again. Percent of people saying family is very important in their life. Even the Germans think it's kind of important. Barely, you know, they're 82 though, still. So it's not that people don't think it's important. They do think it's important. They're confused about how to get there. Family life satisfaction and married. Percent who say they're very satisfied with their family life. It's the married people, of course. And right down from there, down to the divorced, or the most unhappy, of course. So we sense the need. We want it. But how do we get it? First of all, we have to develop an understanding of what it means to have a relationship, a love relationship, that is centered in God. That is what should be the center of all of our lives. And when we get two of us that want to come together and form a marriage centered around God, it's a total life changer. If our relationship is not centered in God, and we're just here, I'm here, she's there, then I tend to kind of define myself by her. This is where we get into those codependent type relationships we were talking about. And so you fall in love and it's all about this new relationship and oh man, all happy, all this and that. I'm dependent on the other for my identity, for my unmet relational needs. I come with this neediness. I have expectations that need to be met. I don't have a secure base from which to give. Neither of us really know what we are or who we are. And since we're defining ourselves by each other, it's a moving target, a moving standard that leads to underlying fundamental insecurity there and neediness. I wind up trying to get what I want all the time. She's trying to get what she wants. And our power relations becomes a wrestling match. And the power relations determine who dominates. Usually one of us gets the upper hand. That's typical. What is it when we say a relationship centered in God? First of all, it means that we define ourselves by who God says we are. My definition of self, my sense of identity, comes from who I am created in the image of God and who He says I am. Because of that, I don't need her to tell me who I am or to show me why I matter. I already know that. She doesn't need me for that. So we're coming in, instead of with chains in our hands, we're coming with empty hands into the relationship. My own relational need for a sense of unity and oneness is met, first of all, by my relationship with God. So that I am fundamentally not a lonely person, even before we get into this relationship. The deepest inner loneliness that is a driving force in so many people's lives is slaked. That thirst is slaked in the first place by reuniting ourselves with God, as we were designed to be from the beginning, and not being separate from Him. That means that instead of depending on each other, we're free to give from an abundance. We get our supply from God and we can give rather than be takers. There's also this idea as well that as we grow closer to God, we kind of grow closer to one another. A very real thing in a God-centered relationship. That's what we're both trying to do. It's no longer what does he want or what does she want. The question now is what does God want? It's a God-centered relationship. And so, man, things just look totally different from that point of view. To be center of relationship in God. Yeah, that's exactly. Here's the pattern that he's given us. Every passage about marriage in the New Testament is always given in the context of the body of Christ, too. And so it's not the nuclear family existing off by themselves, but rather supported and built into a network of friendship relationships, which is also feeding and nurturing to the marriage. Secondly, I need to develop and learn the relational skills that I lack. So, you know, spending some extra hours at the gym trying to get the buns of steel probably isn't going to help that much, actually. What helps a marriage is the ability to relate to another person. And a lot of us don't have enough of that. And this is why we're going to be in the hurt box when we get married. We're going to find out how short we are and short supply some of these relational skills are. One of the best ways to tell is check out your relationships with your roommates. How are you doing at the ministry house? Some of us are afraid to even move into a ministry house because we're afraid we just won't be able to handle it. True, there is pressure there. It's hard to relate to people at that distance where you're getting kind of close enough to be into each other's crap. You know, you start to learn. You know, the person seems like a perfectly good person until they move into the ministry house. Now all of a sudden there's all this selfishness and all of this irritability and all of this vacantness and distance. And you're like, oh, well, so this is what you're really like. This is the classic case. You know, the couple get married, they come running into the counselor. Oh, he's changed. I don't know what's happening. He's totally different. Really? His friends don't think he's any different. Nobody else, nobody in the family thinks he's any different. He's not any different. You just never knew what he was like. That's what happened. It's crucial, too, that we reserve sexual love for that committed state, that we do not profane sexuality. Yeah, that's right. Let's just imagine a continuum from at one extreme, total life commitment, and at the other extreme, no commitment at all. You're on daily probation. It should be pretty clear that at the bottom, that situation is perfectly set up for self-gratification. That's where I want to keep things. If I'm here to gratify myself to the max, is I'm going to take whatever I can, but I'm keeping perfect freedom to get out of here at the first time. If someone better shows up, I'm going to go for that. Or if I decide that you're a nuisance, I'm going to get rid of you. So, at the opposite extreme would be where self-giving love resides. The top, life commitment, self-giving love, is the venue where we can build a successful marriage. And there is no other way. This is the way marriage works. If you want a family, if you're part of the 94% that say that that's very important to you in the U.S., or even if you're German and you're part of the 82%. This is what it's going to take. You're going to have to accept that commitment and sexuality need to go together. When we break that design of God, then that is an inner tearing. We're tearing the fabric of the soul in a very profound way, maybe much more profound than you think. We could be compromising our ability to form total commitment later on. And this is the real danger. People say, well, be sure to use a condom so you can have safe sex that way. There's no such thing as immoral sex that's safe sex. You cannot protect yourself against the damage that is done in the soul. And this is why it has to be avoided. And this is why he says this in this passage. I'll give you a little slogan. I got this. Someone told me this in college and I never forgot it. Love can always wait to give, but lust can never wait to take. Yeah. You should be able to see that's true, how true that truly is. There's one more verse. that we didn't get to. Verse 8. Anyone who refuses to live by these rules is not disobeying human rules, but is rejecting God, who gives his Holy Spirit to you. Whoa! What an amazing claim that is. He's saying this is not a cultural construct. This is not to do with the ancient world or the Victorian world. This is God, the unchanging God of the universe, who has declared and created us to be this way. So if you throw this off, that's who you're throwing off. And you know, we can change, culture can change their standards. They do change all the time. But the infinite personal moral God is not going to change his character to accommodate our sin. All right. Let me just be sure that we're quite practical. What am I suggesting specifically for a single? Let's say you're a single person here. The first thing you need to do is get in touch with the love of God. And it says in 1 John 4:19, we love because he first loved us. That's the crucial thing we have to get in touch with, the forgiveness and the love of God. Some of us have already created a pretty big mess in our lives in this whole area, haven't we? We've done some things that we wish we hadn't done. And it's crucial that we get in touch with the grace and the forgiveness of God. God is a changer of lives. He can take you back to a state that you had lost a long time ago. And to a very substantial extent can repair damage that we've done in our lives and make it so that we're actually back again in pretty good shape to have a successful life. And that's what's at stake here when it comes to marriage, is your life. Invite God into your life. Yeah, it's very much just an inward heart thing. You know, it's not joining a church. It's not saying a list of things. It's opening your heart to God and saying, I want that forgiveness that Jesus gives, and I want to have you in my life, and I want to have that relationship with you. That's what then makes it possible to start thinking about having that God-centered relationship down the line. And then secondly, just begin preparing your love life for a love life with a future mate by learning the relational skills you need. And there's no better place to learn it than in the body of Christ. Here you have a group of people who are all interested in learning the same thing. What does it really mean to forgive? You know, why can't I communicate very well? Why do I always get touchy when I try to? You know, why am I so self-protective and I don't know how to come out of my shell and I don't know what to say and I feel awkward and how do I overcome that kind of stuff? This is the venue where you learn those kind of things in the community of God, which is a safer venue. And when progress has come along there, you'll see for yourself, I feel much better now about getting married and finding someone else probably who's doing the same thing. And there's a pretty good action plan that could lead to some very successful marriages and families like we see all the time. I speak myself. I've been married for 39 years to the same woman. I've raised children. I have grandchildren. A happy family. We still gather together. We still relate as a family. It's a place of love. Everyone in our family would say that we're super happy about our family. This is not a pipe dream. This is not some far out thing that can't be done. It can be done. It is done all the time by walking believers right in our midst. And you know, you probably have models right there in front of you that you can think of where you know that and you get to see with your eyes. This is real. Well, there you have chapter 4, part 1. Next week, Paul gets into what's going to happen in the future, in future history, which is a pretty interesting subject in its own right.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.